Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the second day of Russian airstrikes in Syria that are not targeting the Islamic State as Putin promised, but are bombing other rebel fighters who are enemies of the Islamic State. Jeremy Shapiro, a fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy and the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, joins us. He previously was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Levant, and we will discuss how the Russians now appear to be plunging into a proxy war while the US is licking its wounds from its failed interventions in prior proxy wars as Obama shows reluctance to repeat past mistakes. Then we'll examine a possible palace coup underway in Saudi Arabia and speak with David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, where a letter from an unnamed grandson of the late king has just been published that blames the current king and his young son, who effectively runs the kingdom, for endangering the monarchy's survival, warning, quote, "We will not be able to stop the draining of money, the political adolescence, and the methods of decision-making, even if that implied changing the king himself." Then finally, we'll look into who funded the Tea Party and are they getting their money's worth as the so-called Freedom Caucus in the House threatens another government shutdown in December, with one of their own, Kevin McCarthy, poised to take over as Speaker of the House from John Boehner, who quit because he was tired of the endless battles with the fractious and nihilistic Tea Party caucus. Thomas Ferguson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, who conducted research into who funded the Tea Party, joins us. And joining us now is Jeremy Shapiro, who is a fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also the editor of the Foreign Policy Program's blog, Order from Chaos, a how-to guide for managing the end of the post-Cold War era. Prior to rejoining Brookings, he was a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, where he advised the Secretary of State on U.S. policy in North Africa and the Levant. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Shapiro.
Thanks for having me.
And it does appear that Russian President Putin has rather successfully inserted himself into the Syrian conflict, in effect posing as a part of the solution when he's been a part of the problem all along. But he has certainly created a certain amount of leverage for himself. So what is the U.S. to do? I mean, here he is saying that he's going to join the fight against the Islamic State. And he's, so far, in the last 2 days, Russia has attacked the Army of Conquest and the al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front and the Islamist group Ahrar al-Sham, all of whom oppose the Islamic State. So it's pretty brazen what he's doing.
Yeah, it's quite brazen. By the way, the Russians have said that they intend to attack those types of organizations as well as ISIS. But your general point is well taken, that that they've inserted themselves into this civil war, and they have attempted to sort of change the diplomatic conversation, and that's creating a lot of pressure, I think, for the United States to respond and to sort of demonstrate strength. And I think that Putin is, and the Russians in general, are promoting this idea that they are bold, that they are men of action, and that puts pressure on the United States to respond in the same way. And they are bold. This is clearly a very bold move, but, you know, bold is a kind way of saying stupid. In this case, the Russians are doing things in Syria which aren't going to help the Syrians for sure. They're not even going to help Russia. They're certainly also not going to help the United States. It's kind of a disaster all around. And I think it's difficult. I think the United States has to be careful not to react out of a sense of wanting to be equally bold and appearing to be equally decisive and then deciding to do something which is boldly stupid.
But at this point, what he seems to be doing, what Putin seems to be doing, obviously in coordination with the Assad regime, is taking pressure off where the Assad regime is most under threat, which is in Damascus. And there's been a sense that Damascus has been poised to fall and that the Assad's perhaps had a contingency plan to fall back to Latakia and Tartus, where the Russians have a base, and the coastal mountain area, and create a kind of redoubt there. But I understand that the Iranians and the Russians don't want to lose Damascus. So is this a military push? Because the Iranians are sending in military units as we speak.
Yeah, it's certainly a military push. But think about what you just said. The Assad regime is under a lot of pressure. It's not winning this war. It's, you know, arguably also not losing it, but it's probably losing it slowly. And the trends were against the Assad regime. The reason that that was happening was because the United States and its allies had upped the external support to the Syrian opposition in the last year, and the tide of war had turned against Assad, and he has some very serious long-term weaknesses. So the Russians and the Iranians have counter-escalated, and that can prolong the civil war, but of course there will be another counter-escalation, less from the United States than from other regional powers that are allied with the United States. And that means that, you know, this can definitely provide some breathing space for Assad, but it doesn't address his fundamental weaknesses in the country, which is that the vast majority of the population is deeply against him, that he has a serious manpower shortage, and that he's a brutal dictator without a lot of external support. So the United States has a lot of experience in fighting and losing proxy civil wars in the Middle East, and I think the Russians are probably making a mistake to get themselves involved in one.
Well, if the strategy, though, and you said that they may, or at least they promised to go after the Islamic State at some point, but if they're concentrating on hitting al-Nusra and the Army of Conquest, etc., other factions that are opposed to the Islamic State, at the end of the day, that by that logic, aren't they helping the Islamic State? And wouldn't the end result of a conquest... go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, but I don't think it's worth seeing it quite that mechanistically. The truth is that al-Nusra is an al-Qaeda affiliate. It's probably a greater danger to the United States than ISIS is. You could argue about that all day, but they're certainly not a friend of the United States or of Russia. And the Russian argument is that the U.S. strategy of saying that ISIS is somehow different from these groups is a little bit confused, and that they are all Islamist groups. And there's a certain truth to that. I mean, it varies a little bit amongst the groups. The Syrian civil war is deeply confused. But the fact that Nusra is opposed to ISIS doesn't make them a friend of the United States. Quite the contrary. They're a sworn enemy of the United States. And we have always had a problem in our strategy that if we defeated ISIS, it's not clear that that the day after they were gone, the United States would be any better off in Syria. And I think, you know, it makes sense for the Russians to point that out. As I said, I don't think what they're doing is constructive for the situation either. But we have to accept that we have a confusion in our policy, which is that we haven't really identified all of our enemies and we haven't even found any friends.
Well, is that to say then that the apparent Israeli strategy of stepping back and letting their enemies kill each other, is that the strategy that we should adopt? I mean, it seems that the world attention is such, particularly with the refugee crisis in Europe, that you don't have the luxury of stepping back and having your enemies kill each other.
I mean, it's certainly not a strategy that I would advise, if there were other alternatives. But it's all well and good to say we don't have the luxury of stepping back. But in order to step forward, you have to have a plan that can actually improve the situation. And the truth is, the Syrian civil war problem, which is a problem that we've been trying to deal with for 3 or 4 years, it is not simply, as is often stated in the U.S., a question of political will or leadership or even resources. We do not know how to solve this problem. We failed to solve a similar problem in Iraq and in Libya and in Afghanistan, all trying a variety of different mechanisms. None of them worked. We don't know how to solve the Syrian civil war. We can certainly do some things, and we can certainly change the situation. But in my view, that would be irresponsible unless we have some sense, some belief of our own that it would work. Now, the migration crisis and the various humanitarian problems that are emanating from Syria are extremely serious, not only for the countries of Europe, but for the immense numbers of people that are suffering, and we should try to deal with those problems. It's true that those are symptoms of the disease of the Syrian civil war. But look, if you don't know how to cure a disease, you don't pretend that you can. You treat the symptoms. We can treat the symptoms of this. We can do a lot more to help the humanitarian situation, particularly within Syria's neighbors, to help the refugees, both in Syria's neighbors and beyond. And we should do that. But if we distract ourselves by imagining that we can cure a disease that we cannot cure, we will certainly not help those people, and we might make their situation worse.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Shapiro, who's a fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also the editor of the Foreign Policy Program's blog, Order from Chaos, and a how-to guide for managing the end of the post-Cold War era. Prior to rejoining Brookings, he was a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, where he advised the Secretary of State on U.S. policy in North Africa and the Levant. But, of course, Vladimir Putin's argument all along has been that the United States has deposed secular dictators who have been replaced by religious fanatics. So you're not suggesting that, given that's our track record, that Putin is right?
I think that Putin is right about the American record in the Middle East. He's right that the intervention efforts that we have undertaken have not resulted in greater stability. I think that's undeniable if you look at the last 15 years of the U.S. involvement in the Middle East. I don't think he's right that what he's doing will be any better. I think it might even be worse. But, you know, just because he's wrong doesn't mean that we're right. And I think we have to deal with our own sins. His critique of our policy is better than his own policy.
And in terms of how much the U.S. has sacrificed for Iraq, it does seem deeply insulting that the Iraqis are not cooperating with the U.S. In fact, they're sharing intelligence with the Russians. Does that mean that we simply don't have any leverage anymore, even though there we are in Iraq helping the Iraqi government fight against the Daesh, the Islamic State?
Yeah, you know, I think gratitude is in short supply in these situations. And so in the first instance, we can't expect whatever we might have done in the past to create that. But you rightly emphasized that it's really a question of leverage. We do have a certain amount of leverage in Iraq, and I think we conceivably could use it in this instance, but I think the problem we have with exercising our leverage in Iraq is that we've made it very clear to the Iraqi government that it's a core American interest to support them and to prevent the ISIS from toppling them. And so they're not really scared that we are going to abandon them. And so it makes it difficult for us to exercise the leverage that we do have. I think if we were going to exercise that leverage, we would have to be let's say, less wrapped up in a policy sense in the success of the Iraqi state.
But are we deluding ourselves that there is such a thing as the Iraqi state?
There's definitely such a thing as the Iraqi state. The question is really, what does it control? Which is, I guess, so makes your point. I think, you know, this is a government which has, you know, a control over a fair amount of the country, but basically is not in control of Kurdistan, and is certainly not in control of the ISIS areas of western and northern Iraq. And so it's not a government, well, it's a government that has important areas of control. Baghdad is obviously a huge and important city. It's not running the entire country of Iraq.
But there's some confusion as to whether or not the Obama administration's efforts to degrade and destroy the Islamic State, which is placed right there in the middle of Iraq and in Syria as well. There's been reports of discord amongst military intelligence people, saying that the top brass has been sanitizing their more pessimistic assessments. What's going on there? Do you think that this administration just wants this issue to sort of, you know, be manageable without exploding any more, and they're going to leave it up to the next presidency? Is there a shadow game going on here?
I think that there is a bit, although I wouldn't have described it exactly the way that you did. I think that the effort against the Islamic State has not been using the full force of American power, to put it mildly. It's been by the standards of U.S. military operations relatively low level, and I think that that reflects the Obama administration view that a greater effort would only suck the U.S. in more, and that it would, and that while it might destroy the Islamic State, it's not really destroying the Islamic State is not a goal in of itself. It would not actually stabilize the situation in Iraq or Syria, even if successful on those terms. So what they're trying to do, as you pointed out, is to contain the problem, is to get it out of the front pages a little bit so that they can deal with it more intelligently, and then most fundamentally to leave it not to the next administration but to the regional enemies of ISIS, which are legion and which should be able to, with some relatively minor help from the United States, eventually step up and push back the Islamic State. And that is why the president, when he talked about the beginning of this campaign last year, he said that this was a multi-year campaign, because the issue was never the United States going in with the full force of its might and wiping this group from the face of the earth. It was containing it and standing up regional allies that could ultimately defeat it.
So could the Russian intervention then provoke the United States into being more assertive?
It could. It's the view in Washington but the view within the administration that's not really a good idea, because there's not really more assertive things that are smart to do. But I think, as this conversation is sort of reflecting, the domestic politics of that here are very difficult. And whether the president will decide, as he has often decided in the past, that he needs to do something which is on some level a sort of demonstration to his own public that he's seized with the situation, that he has ideas and plans and solutions, whether he'll feel the need to do that in this case, I think, is an open question. He may well.
Well, just in closing, Jeremy Shapiro, do you go along with a lot of the punditry that's suggesting that Putin blindsided the U.S., that Putin has been running rings around Obama? That's certainly the Republican narrative.
Yes, it's a common narrative even beyond the Republicans. I don't quite hold to it. I mean, I think that the United States was a little bit surprised by this move, for sure. At least I was. But I think that the reason that we were surprised is because it's a very stupid thing to do. And, you know, stupidity is always difficult to predict. And I think it's very important, as I think I said at the beginning, not to react to stupid things by doing your own stupid things. Putin has demonstrated that he is bold here. Boldness is not an attribute personally that I want to see in my government's foreign policy. I want to see we are a status quo power with a lot to lose. And I think boldness is definitely overestimated. It really works well in the press, obviously, and that's why Putin's move is playing very well in the U.S. and the Russian press. It's not playing so well on the ground in Syria, and I think the coming months and possibly years are going to demonstrate that even more strongly.
Well, since we're told that President Obama thinks Putin is a thug and Putin thinks President Obama's a weakling, I guess what you're saying is I bet on the weakling over the thug.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't really accept the characterization. I think that the idea that it's important for an American president to be strong in that way misconstrues where American power comes from. It doesn't come from the machismo of our president. It doesn't come from his decisiveness. It comes from our deep strengths as a country. It comes from our from the values that animate us and which power our economic system. We never win our wars quickly, but we generally win them. And the reason is because, or at least we cut our losses. And the reason is because we are slow to action, but ultimately our strengths tell. And that has been a good model for us. That's the model that we've used to take over the world.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeremy Shapiro.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeremy Shapiro, who's a fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Center for the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. He's also the editor of the Foreign Policy Program's blog, Order from Chaos, a how-to guide for managing the end of the post-Cold War era. And prior to rejoining Brookings, he was a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, where he advised the Secretary of State on U.S. policy in North Africa and the Levant. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining a possible palace coup underway in Saudi Arabia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is David Hurst. He's the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was a chief foreign leader writer for The Guardian and former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief and European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. He has a unusual letter from an unnamed grandson of the late Saudi king published at Middle East Eye that indicates that all is not well within the kingdom and within the ruling family. So what does this mean? Is there a kind of counter coup going on against King Salman and his son, who's effectively ruling the kingdom?
Well, I think before you answer that question, I think we have to go back over the sort of really quite traumatic events of the death of the last king and exactly the circumstances in which the current king took power. There was a real power struggle going on. It was by no means the sort of smooth succession that King Salman said at the time. And what really happened in the last hours of life of the dying king was an attempt to sort of basically rewrite his will and to write King Salman as he was, or the crown prince, out of the succession. That was defeated at the very, very last minute. So there were definitely two clans going at each other as the body of the king was still warm in his grave, and even before he was actually buried. And one side definitely won that power struggle, and the side that won the power struggle is now in power, and that is King Salman. And he put his son as now the deputy crown prince, and a very old friend of his, who's also a relation, who's the crown prince, who is Mohammed bin Nayef. Now, those three basically run the kingdom. One runs the foreign policy, one runs the interior policy, and one is the king who keeps the whole show on the road. However, it has meant that an awful lot of Abdulaziz's other sons have been cut out of the proceedings, and this is a political climate where the winner takes all, and where portfolios, ministerial portfolios, are basically used as goods and chattel, as part of the family wealth basically, and are handed down from prince to princeling, from father to son. So it's entirely within the Saudi tradition that King Salman would award his young son, who's only 30 years old, a massive amount of power. He's basically running a war in Yemen. He's a defense minister, and he's absolutely no military experience at all. So he has a huge amount of power. And, of course, this creates huge opposition because the losers are always rattling the cage. And I think in this case, this is a letter. There are false letters around, but I think this was a genuine one, which said that all was not well. There was a great deal of dissatisfaction in the House of Saud. And the older generation wanted some of the power back. And the person that was being named as the sort of knight in shining white armor was a 73-year-old Prince Ahmed, who is the youngest surviving son of the Suderi clan. He was being mentioned as someone who has had no power. He's 73 years old. And he once served as a deputy interior minister for nearly 30 years from 1975. And he was being mentioned as the person who should basically take over. So I view all of these things with a great pinch of salt. I don't think it's a counter coup. I think there's certainly tensions within the House of Saud, and this will be expressed in London and in the media, certainly in the English language media, like the Middle East Eye, which is like a sort of pressure valve, and it cannot be expressed inside Saudi Arabia itself.
And again, I'm speaking with David Hurst, who is in the UK. He's the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow Bureau chief, European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And he has published at the Middle East Eye a letter from an unnamed grandson of the late Saudi king. And this is a letter apparently that's being circulated amongst Saudi princes. Its author is a grandson of the late King Abdulaziz ibn Saud. And it blames the incumbent king for creating unprecedented problems that endangered the monarchy's survival. Just quoting from the letter, "We will not be able to stop the draining of money, the political adolescence, and the military risks unless we change the methods of decision-making, even if that implied changing the king himself." Those are fighting words.
They are. And it's also got to be said that the reason why King Salman took so much power, and the reason why he really changed the course of Saudi foreign policy in so many respects, was because of the perceived chaos that Saudi Arabia had got itself into under the previous king. We've got to go back a bit and see what Saudi foreign policy was like under the previous king. And it basically funded a military coup in Egypt. It went all out to fight the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist movement, in whichever country it could, particularly in Yemen, including, it's necessary, and there's evidence that it did do that, of inciting the Houthis to revolt against against a Yemeni leader who was elected and who then had to be basically chased into exile. Now, what happened was that Iran profited from the chaos that these policies were basically creating. And Saudi Arabia found itself surrounded on all sides, on all frontiers, with war zones. And one of the big causes of the complete Saudi U-turn in policy, certainly on Yemen and certainly with the Houthis, was the chaos around them in all forms. And Prince Bandar was one of the people who was associated with this chaos. Now what's happening is that Saudi Arabia is fighting a war in Yemen, which is extremely bloody, but is pushing the Houthis back and is also pushing Iran back in, or Iranian-backed Shia groups in a number of places, including Syria and in Iraq. And that is overwhelmingly popular amid the Sunni population. It's not just a sort of dynastic push. It's overwhelmingly popular. So when we say that Yemen is a mess, we have to remember that that mess was created by the previous king himself and his policies. And the current king is responding to that. Now, that's not to say that the bombing of Sana'a and the bombing of Yemen has yielded anything other than complete devastation, high civilian casualties, and huge loss of life. However, the Houthis are being pushed back. Aden is now under control of Saudi and Emirati groups, and the Houthis themselves are very, very unpopular in the south. So the position in Yemen is by no means cut and dried, and the war, although devastating for Yemen, is being fought and still hasn't reached a conclusion. So I think it's too early to say that the Saudi-led assault on Yemen has failed, or that it is unpopular. It may certainly be unpopular around the world, but it is quite popular enough with the Saudi, mainly Sunni, population. And that was one of the reasons that was cited in the conduct of this brutal war in Yemen. It was one of the reasons of dissatisfaction cited in the letter. So, to be fair, again, one has to go back to who actually created the mess. And the thing is very, very much point to the sort of princes that who the letter says were upholding Saudi sovereignty. It wasn't really quite like that. There are other causes of dissatisfaction cited in the letter, and one of them is just plain governance. Saudi Arabia is an incredibly rich country, but it is hemorrhaging funds at the moment. Due to the drop in the oil price has dropped from, if you remember, about $120 a barrel to less than 50. And as a result, Saudi Arabia has been drawing on its foreign currency reserves at a rate of something like $12 billion a month. It's still got a lot in the kitty. It's still got $672 billion in May. But it's down from $737 billion in August last year. So that's quite a big drop. And if it keeps on hemorrhaging money at this rate, I mean, the other thing you've got to mention is that the population is increasing from 29 million to 37 million. And when a Saudi king comes to power, to make himself popular, he just spends money, basically, and gives a lot of it out to students, to workers. It basically gives everyone a pay rise. And the first thing that King Salman did was lavish billions on his own population, bought himself popularity. That happens quite a lot. Someone's got to pay for it. And so the population is increasing. The state revenues are decreasing, admittedly from a very high level. And you only have to just draw a graph to what the finance would be like in 10 years' time, and the picture doesn't look good.
But to the extent that you have this arrangement between the Wahhabis, who maintain a kind of religious control over the country, and essentially the royal family get their authority from them, being the suitable custodians of the holy shrines. And there's a sense that the Wahhabis are basically saying, accept the government and be obedient. But at a certain point, you surely have an emperor's clothes situation. If the invincibility of the government, and the government appears to be incompetent, which they certainly do in terms of this tragedy at the Hajj and the earlier crane crash, is there a possibility that the spell could be broken?
I think you're quite right. I think the spell is being broken gradually. I'm wary of putting a timeline on it because it's been going for some time. I think there's certainly a huge challenge that the current Saudi leadership has, and that is on democratization, basically on producing a modern state out of a very tight autocracy where the state basically exists to serve its rulers. And I have no great hopes that they can manage this transition easily or quickly, but it basically has to happen. I mean, the Hajj, for instance, the story of the Hajj, which has sort of descended into sort of a sectarian slanging match between Saudi Arabia and Iran, really is a very, very simple story of incompetence in moving over a million people around the holy sites of Mecca when, for instance, the train system and the bus system collapsed and you had hundreds of thousands of pilgrims who were dead tired in the heat, basically converging on one small street outside in Mina, and there was an almighty crush and a stampede, and up to 1,000, maybe over 1,000 people were killed, many of them Iranians. That was just sheer incompetence, and it shows the basic disregard for human life. And to be a modern state, I think Saudi Arabia, and even the mood in the country, Saudis have to be treated as citizens, and they have to have the same rights, the same democratic rights, as everyone else does. And it's high time this system has changed. So I think the writing is very, very clearly on the wall. Whether or not the House of Saud can respond to that by a change of power to the younger generation, which is what happened, basically, that the younger generation took over from the older one, whether that can be accompanied by use of democratization, by genuine elections and genuine participatory democracy and transparency in the current atmosphere is really an open question, but it has to happen.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, David Hurst.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, as the editor of the Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and a former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow Bureau Chief, European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. And he has published a letter at the Middle East Eye from an unnamed grandson of the late Saudi king, suggesting that there is a possibility of a palace coup underway in Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into who funded the Tea Party and are they getting their money's worth.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who is an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
So you've done a lot of research into the funding of the very creation of the Tea Party in the first place, and much, if not most, of the money came from Wall Street. Is there a possibility that, given the portent of gridlock and paralysis and the fact that even though the Tea Party candidates like Donald Trump and Ben Carson are dominating the primary races for the president, conventional wisdom is that they're going to pay for that in the general. So is there any buyer's remorse on Wall Street?
Well, I think there's for sure some buyer's remorse on some specific issues. Wall Street, I think, less than most, except where the possibility of a budget gridlock exists. Though remember that some very well-known Wall Streeters, like Stanley Druckenmiller, have periodically talked up the idea of just, you know, letting the budget gridlock for a while. But yes, and for sure, you know, some firms like Boeing and General Electric clearly don't like the opposition to the Export-Import Bank. I mean, you can go through, you know, a list of major U.S. firms and find for sure some folks who don't like it. But, you know, remember that the Tea Party has been solidly committed to deregulation. And on, for example, most of the issues nearest to Wall Street's heart, assuming, of course, it has a heart besides a wallet, they are just very strongly in the Wall Street corner. They are among the strongest proponents in the House generally, and among the House Republicans, of sweeping away the Dodd-Frank reforms, for example. There's not a lot to those reforms, but it still sticks in their craw. And so I think you can sort of overplay this rather too much, but for sure I think there's some buyer's remorse, and there's no doubt that the Chamber of Commerce and some of the large firms have tried to channel money away from some of the Tea Party, especially the leadership, into candidates they regarded as more completely pliable, one wants to say. That's for sure a fact.
But Kevin McCarthy, who's likely to be the new Speaker of the House, I think he's pretty much a Tea Party guy. I mean, he's a global warming denier. He's a drill baby drill guy from Bakersfield, California, out of the oil patch.
Yes.
And he's, I mean, he's the remark that he made on Fox News that the Benghazi committee is not really about finding the truth out about Benghazi, but it's really about hurting Hillary Clinton, would indicate to me that that's who they are and what they're about. And they've been very successful. In terms of dominating the media narrative, you have to admit that if the Tea Party's, you know, bark may be worse than its bite, there's only about 40 or 50 of them in the House, they sure dominate the headlines. You know, effectively, the two top candidates running for president on the Republican side, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, are Tea Partiers, and they get round-the-clock headlines, and guess what? Hillary Clinton barely can get a word out about anything she cares about. You know, all of her policies, prescriptions, they get no coverage whatsoever. But every stupid thing that Trump says, like kicking out the refugees from Syria, headlines, headlines, headlines.
Well, my reaction to that, Ian, is perhaps the issue is less the specificity of the Tea Party than just how far to the right the center in the House among the House Republicans is. I mean, that's another reading of that. And who is a Tea Partier? Well, you know, they don't exactly have membership cards, and there's no they there that could claim to know definitively anyway. I mean, so my sense is you're on firm ground when you sort of just comment on just how incredibly to the right the mainstream House opinion has moved. It really is astounding. And in that sense, whether or not all these folks qualify as Tea Party is maybe the wrong question to ask.
Well, but what I was getting at, Tom Ferguson, is that the Tea Party may not have had much legislative success. They've certainly been successful obstructionists, but they've had amazing success with the media. They are the ones that the media just absolutely parrots everything that they say and do.
I don't quarrel with that, but again, you know, look, my point, Ian, is that if any right-wing member of the House gets up and says almost any right piece of right-wing nonsense, they do very well in the U.S. press, almost without exception. So, right from the craziest stuff to let's, you know, go bomb, fill in the blanks, whatever country somebody's irritated at, you know, Ukraine, Syria, whatever, on down. And so, again, look, we're dealing here with a political formation that is very, very far to the right. And, you know, trying to tell, is it the Tea Party? Is it the center of the House Republicans when they're in the news? If it's nonsense, you can't always differentiate. It's very hard. You need, you know, Anton von Leeuwenhoek and a microscope to tell this, or some kind of specimen test. It's better equipment, I think, than I probably have on some of this stuff.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. So in terms of Kevin McCarthy's truthful gaffe about Benghazi, John Boehner had to go to the rescue there and say, oh, no, it's not really about that.
You
know, and they're
that kind of repair happens. Look, we might pursue this question, though, just a little bit further on the Tea Party and the rest of the Republicans, because my colleagues being Ji Chen and Paul Jorgensen, you know, we actually elaborately analyzed money flows into Tea Party Republicans, where we took the formal membership in the caucus. And a couple of other cases, I think in one usage of it, we included Sarah Palin, for example, who didn't fit that, for Tea Party cash vis-a-vis the rest of the Republican Party. And we got a quite striking result, because if you look in the New York Times and most of the press, they will repeat to you with a straight face that mainstream corporations don't actually move that far from the political center. They quote, you know, analysts expressing this view a lot, and they act like it's true. What we found is that, you know, in one comparison, very obvious, you were far more likely, if you were a large corporation, to have contributed to Tea Party candidates than if you were any of the individual entrepreneurs listed in the Forbes 400. That doesn't mean there aren't some spectacular examples of people on that list who are entrepreneurs in the Forbes 400. In other words, individuals rather than firms who don't contribute to the Tea Party. Everybody knows the Koch cases and things like that. But in general, you know, we found the exact opposite of what people were have been claiming. And, you know, it sort of makes my point about just how crazy is the Tea Party? They're about almost as crazy as the corporate mainstream wants them to be. A little bit beyond it, but not that much. In a few cases, you see some differences. But that's the big story here is, if you like, that the asylum seems completely full of inmates, and it's hard to tell in the left wing or the right wing of that particular asylum, whether anybody isn't crazy after all.
So if you make the analogy of the attack dog that's a sweet puppy, but as you feed it and feed it and feed it, it turns into a dangerous beast, and then it could at some point turn on its owner. You don't think that that's happening?
I don't think there's going to be much of that. Let's wait and see. This is a testable case. If they let the Export-Import Bank expire, you know, I'll agree that, you know, you've got a really interesting case there. That hasn't happened yet. And I'm betting that the new Republican leadership is going to find a way to keep it going. If they have to do it with Democratic votes, they'll probably end up doing it. But let's see. You know, we can reassess this. I do not disagree that there is a vocal minority of Tea Party folks who talk like they're the whole Tea Party caucus, although when you start to look at them, that tends to dissolve a bit. We'll just have to see.
So let me try to pose a different framework then for this discussion.
Sure.
Do you think that it's just basically inherent in most of the corporate titans in this country, and particularly the Koch brothers and others, that you don't want your political agents to be particularly clever, you just want them to be obedient, and that if you have these people that arguably are obedient, if not a little dangerous, is that because if you look at the record of what the Republicans have done since they've controlled the House, They have not done anything, no legislation, nothing, except have these kangaroo court committees, whether it's the Benghazi committee or all of the idiocy that Darrell Issa has put on. So is that, are they carrying the water for the oligarchy, for the want of a better description, in as much as the oligarchy believes that government should get out of the way and let them run the world? And if that's their framework, then they're doing a good job, the Tea Party.
You know, without trying to comment on the individual psychology of any of the folks, I think you can say the following, that the whole program of corporate mainstream America now, less a few, some interesting deviations in particular sectors and things like that, has been pretty much let's dismantle the New Deal and just about every form of social protection. In that respect, nobody wants new legislation. They just want old legislation wiped out. Either allowed to expire or repealed. You know, it's not like anybody very much in the financial community. There are a few folks. In a long discussion, we could discuss that. There's some intrasectoral rivalries there, but mostly the bulk of the financial community would just like to get rid of Dodd-Frank. They don't want new legislation. You know, I mean, in any sort of serious fashion. And so, you know, that the Tea Party, the idea of, you know, pushing, getting rid of the state, making it, it's saying it can't do anything constructive, you know, helped along by the inability of people running the state to do much constructive, I would add, then the Tea Party carries water for, if you like, all oligarchs, and they appreciate that. But, you know, this is also a view shared by the corporate mainstream. I mean, you're dealing here with a business community that is quite far to the right. You're way past the pillars of Hercules of the conventional American imagination. And you can see this when, you know, some newspapers, when they want to go find something, they don't shoot down something they don't like. They will go almost desperately to find one business spokesperson. It's as though that's the only voice they really care about.
Well, then what is their ultimate vision for America? Warren Buffett, who's one of the richest businessmen in the country, warned that the U.S. is in danger of becoming a plantation economy. That appears to be the vision of the oligarchy.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, it was put to me by one gentleman very famous on Wall Street for financing the Tea Party and other right-wing operations. He just put it to me, why should I pay for education in the United States? I can get any amount of educated labor from the rest of the world. The only place where that view stops is when they go into China and they get themselves in trouble. In other words, in the national state system. Or when they encounter really giant events, you know, the breakup of the whole existing North African system, or, you know, the endless sort of now chaotic situation in the Middle East. At that point, you still get the night watchman state gets replaced by something much bigger than the night watchman. But if you're talking, what's the corporate average model? It's pretty much that, you know, strong defense, millions for defense, and not one cent for the domestic spending, you know, to sort of bury the famous old line of Stephen Decatur on Tribute. There are exceptions. There are pieces of the action. People in telecommunications and health, for example, need laws. They can't get the show to work without them because the situation simply will not. The combination of the market and existing policy isn't viable. But, you know, those are exceptional cases. The mainstream average here is, you're in another world, where one I would add where there is some evidence that even conventional views that democracy is the way to go are becoming somewhat unpopular there.
So, but just in terms of the America that they have to live in, the oligarchs, are they so insulated? Are they living in such gated communities and private heliports, etc., I mean, occasionally if they have to go to a five-star restaurant, they have to step over homeless people on the grates outside the restaurant. That doesn't bother them?
Well, you know, again, I don't have access to anybody's individual minds. It obviously bothers some of them. And for sure, the general feeling that there's a threat. Ever since Occupy burst forth, you could see the feeling of threat in the business community get much stronger. And indeed, you know, my colleagues and I wrote a piece in the International Journal of Political Economy for 2013 when we were walking through the money in 2012, and we just noticed how what had been a sort of overgrown national security state, which had been blown up to enormous size after 9/11, then starts to merge with sort of the corporate folks to the point where they all mutually consult each other. You know, you can call up a federal agency to find out if your chief executive should go make a speech in Arizona or New Mexico. That's the case we actually discussed. That's well documented. And you've got, it's, if you like, you know, Big Brother and the holding company have been getting firmly together there, and that's not, that's a very deep-seated trend. You may be sliding into a post-democratic age here.
The deep state, as it's called. But I guess that's how they've also transferred money away from social needs to right-wing welfare. The military-industrial complex, the intelligence-industrial complex, that's all a form of right-wing welfare.
Well, it's as long as we extend that. Now, that you're going to have to extend to the, you know, big mainstream parts of the Democratic Party, because...
Sure, that's how that...
Yeah. I mean, that huge amounts of... I mean, look, a good chunk of the national security budget, an enormous amount, including and especially on intelligence, is privatized. Now, I mean, the wholesale privatization of the functions of the state in defense is a very marked trend. And, yeah, you can treat that as corporate welfare. I think it's going to generate the same type of disasters that private prisons have generated, you know, where you got the prisons agitating to arrest more people just so they can stay filled and make more money. This has become crazy.
Right. Well, look at the example of the OPM hack. That was enabled by the fact that all that data that the Office of Personnel Management had on every American spy and every government contract and every American who applied for a security clearance, that was handled by a contractor, and it ended up totally in the hands of the Chinese and probably the Russians,
yep,
too. Well, yep. I thank you, Tom Ferguson. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And
all right. Well, thank you, Ian. Let's just see how we... Let's watch the Export-Import Bank.
Okay.
And how they handle that. I think this will be a very interesting test.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.